The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Heretics Hour on Monday, September 17th, 2012. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host for the next 2 hours. I don't have a guest tonight, even though I have a specialized topic. As I thought about asking the Circumcision Resource Center if they could make someone available, it occurred to me that they would be pointing out the pros and cons of circumcision, which we mostly already know, I think, and I will be going over that in the beginning of the program. And but really what I want to do is approach the subject from a white nationalist point of view, as in how do we use this issue to our benefit. So I decided that I didn't need someone from there, and I would just do it myself. I had previously written to Matthew Hess, the creator of Foreskin Man, about appearing, and he declined. So I thought, well, I'll just do this myself and take it where I want to take it. And I'm glad to see I've got some listeners out there. Thank you for being here, and I want to remind you that you can join the program by email, by writing to carolyn@carolynyeager.com with any questions or comments. I really wish on a show like tonight that I had the phone lines here, but we don't have the phone lines yet. So, well, that's just it. We just don't. So, we still have to use the email, but I want to remind you that I will try to remember to check that. In fact, I'm checking it right now. Don't see anything there yet. Okay, but before I start on this topic of circumcision, I want to say a few words about preaching to the choir. This is not in the spirit of disapproval of anyone, and I hope it will not sound that way, but it's in how I see what we can be doing, and of course, that is in dealing with our white folk, our white brethren. And of course, not everybody will be doing the same thing, nor should everybody have to do the same thing. But I do want to speak about how I see it and how the White Network sees it. Excuse me, in my opinion, I'm going to refer to last Monday's Heretics Hour with Dietrich and Mischko, who were the creators of Voice of Reason Radio Network. Dietrich used the term circle jerk in reference to his idea that good content or good quality audio and presentation is what is important to reach, quote, societal elites, not trying to reach the choir. That's a circle jerk, unquote. Now, a circle jerk, I had to even look it up to make sure. I mean, I knew somebody had talked about it, so I knew. I guess I'd heard that before, but I really didn't even pay attention to it when he said it, and it's not something that I've come across very often, but it is a slang expression for a pointless group endeavor, and that's the meaning that that's what he was meaning by it, a pointless group endeavor, or something that just goes around in a circle and doesn't go anywhere else. That is, if we're just talking to one another, is the idea of preaching to the choir, excuse me, and we're not reaching new people. So in that regard, he also mentioned that he believes one elite is worth 100 proles and ditch diggers. Well, Dietrich has a PhD now, and he's probably right, but that's not going to make friends with proles. However, that's not the issue. At the end of the program, he said, quote, Alex, meaning Alex Linder, thinks we were trying to soften our image, but we're just trying to not preach to the choir. With VOR, that's a little bit of a circle jerk, and we want to go out and win new hearts and minds, unquote. In fact, he said in so many words that the choir should be sending money and supporting them in any way they could, but we're not going to get the red meat they liked at what they liked at VNN, I suppose. They weren't going to get that at VOR. Well, I can't speak for him. That's just some of what it sounded like. So, but the idea about preaching to the choir, well, I have one more little thing that he said. He said a mission statement makes us too rigid. He doesn't want one statement, he said. He doesn't want to just put out one statement as he is starting up Voice of Reason again, sort of. It's not clear at all just what direction it's going to go in, and it's not supposed to be because he hasn't taken it there yet. So it's all kind of, he doesn't decide these things obviously in advance, but I asked him what Whitelandia meant to him, and he said Whitelandia doesn't mean anything. He wants what he's doing to be free and flexible, and so a mission statement, one statement, would not leave him free and flexible. And that is the difference. That's a difference between him and us here at the White Network. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because for me, preaching to the choir, that phrase is a negative spin put on what is really an important endeavor. That is encouraging, educating, identifying, and yes, pulling together a solid number of white partisans and racialists who really get it, by excluding all the infectious agents of multiculturalism, liberalism, Zionism, internationalism, money chasing, open homosexuality, humanitarianism, and tolerance with a capital T as defined by Jews. So all of those things we wanted and we intend to deal with at the White Network. I don't particularly like the phrase preaching to the choir, but we do want to speak to our own people, and we think that that's an important work to do, and we don't think that it's a circle jerk. So I just have a little bit of a problem when that endeavor is portrayed that way as unimportant and backward looking. But again, as I said, this was just this is a difference of opinion. I have something here. I hope I really want to say this. I've got it written down here, so I guess. The subject was brought up on last week's program that I had an axe to grind. Oh, yeah, I do. I do want to say it. Against Voice of Reason. Well, it is true that the White Network was formed because of dissatisfaction with Voice of Reason. My dissatisfaction. It came about in reaction to what was going on at VOR. Naturally, when our new network came online, I was free to say things that I felt constrained to say on Voice of Reason. I had said those things in private to Mike Connor, for one, but even to another host, which caused him to cancel my mailings because I guess I was a little too blunt. But now I could say it more publicly, since I was no longer on Voice of Reason. And I think the differences among us are very important, and this needs to be a part of the dialogue among white people that we need to have. I just don't agree with those who say we should not disagree in public, but put forth a unified front. I would say we're not ready for that yet because we haven't hashed out all the issues, and what simmers under the surface is what eventually breaks out in destructive ways. Better to talk about it now, and Alex Linder, for one, has said that too, or he said it first. I received an email from someone named Bruce Langland today, or was it yesterday? And it was titled 330,000 Downloads Per Show on VOR. And I'm going to read this to you. At first I thought, is this person serious? And I thought, well, he was. But then later I decided that I didn't think this was from anyone named Bruce Langland, but it was from somebody I know who is trying to be helpful to me, who said something similar to this, actually sending me an email during last Monday's program. But it's interesting. Oh, I forgot to, narrow it, so I have to move my thing around to read it. But he says, "Hi, Carolyn." Well, I think it's instructive. I hope I'm not, saying I'm just, spinning my wheels here talking about this, but I'll read it. "Hi, Carolyn. I just wanted to make a comment on what Dietrich and Mishko said about the number of downloads and your disbelief. You have to understand that these guys have a strong following. They go way back. Now, I'm going to refer to them going way back after I read the whole thing. And when you say you don't believe them, you make yourself sound like you're, should I say, jealous. There's a lot of misspelled words in all of this, but I'm not going to point them out. But the bottom line is telling the truth. And I believe that everyone that has broadcast on VOR has strived to tell the truth. When you cast doubt, you make yourself look like a fool to the audience that trusts what Dietrich and Mischko are saying. Well, I would just say in here, who is a fool who trusts what people say on the internet without a fact check? But he goes on, as a friend, I will tell you, don't do that because you're only hurting yourself and you will chase people away from your broadcasts. In the white nationalist movement, Dietrich and Mischko are like divinity. Yeah, he said that. You are getting a following as well, but don't tarnish it by petty bickering. We all need to strive to tell the truth so we can wake people up. And signed, Bruce Langland. So I asked, what is way back? And as I said last week, or actually Saturday, I think, before last Monday, I had looked back at all this, and the earliest show I could find by Dietrich on BNN, that is Vanguard News Network, is Free Talk Live of June 29, 2007 with Bud White and Dietrich. And he was on Free Talk Live again on July 12th, 2007. And I see Mischko first mentioned in the program notes on August 30th, 2007 in an impromptu show with Bud White and Randy Gray. And he doesn't appear again in the notes until December 21st, where he's mentioned as the resident VNN bad boy. So maybe he was on some of the other programs. His name just wasn't in the program notes. He becomes co-host on Free Talk Live in January 2008. And then, you know, he's there again on January, February, two times in February, and then not mentioned anymore because, as I pointed out, that's when they were working on forming Voice of Reason, which they at that time were calling Whitelandia. And the first shows appeared, I believe, in April 2nd. That network opened. So they were involved in that. So it doesn't, if somebody can point out to me that they go way back further than that, do so, because I don't know, I could be wrong, but the furthest back I can go is, 2007, summer 2007, on VNN, which, in 2007, summer 2007, in the spring, I was working on my first website, which was quite a chore, I'll tell you. But I finally got something put up, and that summer I spent trying to put a lot of content on it. I worked very hard on it. It was very much of a homemade thing. I didn't know enough to, like, go to WordPress or something like that. I thought I didn't want to. I didn't want a blog, I thought. I wanted a website, not a blog. But, you know, I didn't know all that much, but I was also writing, had been writing throughout 2006 maybe it was late 2006, 2007. And then, in 2008, I began working with Wilhelm Christman, translating from German to English, Ein Ende für Hitler by Hermann Giesler. And I was writing other things, and I just kept writing more and more after that. So I was involved from 2007, at the same time that I first see them show up myself, although I didn't have a radio program. So, the point of all this is that what do I think white nationalists should be doing? Well, I think they should be working for white people's interests in real ways. Well, let me just go back to Bruce Langland. So I think that this is somebody that I know who somehow thinks that Dietrich and Mischko are really big, especially Mischko is really big to him. And he's afraid I'm going to make enemies of everyone. And he's a friend of mine, and he's trying to warn me about all this. So I thank him for that. If he's the person I think he is, but I think he goes a little too far when he says Dietrich and Mischko are like divinity. Maybe to him. Okay, so what do I think white nationalists should be doing? I think they should be working for white people's interests in real ways, like the German National Socialists did, and like Hamas does today, and Hezbollah, I understand, does. Not just publishing airy-fairy books and articles and asking for major contributions to allow one or two people to become leading figures in the movement, but looking for issues that are wedge issues and that have the potential to be winning issues for us if we're not going to get out there in the world, and some of us can't really do that. Looking for strong issues that will really draw some attention. And I think circumcision is an issue that fits that perfectly. It's not new. I'm not certainly not the first one to bring it up. Particularly, it's come up in the news recently, big time, which brought it to my attention. And I recognized, as so many others have, that it's an idea whose time has come that we could use this to separate Jews from ourselves, potentially in a better way than anything else we have to work with at the moment. So I'll just say that circumcision should be a major issue of the pro-white community. It's a winning issue. Organized Jewry is very vulnerable on this issue. And someone wrote to me during the week or week ago or so and called it the Jews' Achilles heel. And I can really agree with that. It is. So tonight, I'm going to begin my discussion and my so-called publicity campaign against circumcising white baby boys. All right. You already said this. I repeated myself. What we don't know. Okay, we can find all we need to know about circumcision itself on the internet. But what we don't know and what we have to figure out is how to use this issue to remove white Christian people just one step further away from Jews and Muslims. Probably a lot of the more atheistic type people maybe don't circumcise their children. They have no interest in it. But it may be that it is mostly Christian people who are still drawn to do it because it's in the Bible. And so they may be the ones who we can change the most to encourage this. We want to encourage this because this can separate us from Jews and Muslims more than anything else, maybe at this time. We all know the problem of crypto Jews and Jews infiltrating our organizations. If Christians and non-Christian white men were not circumcised, were never circumcised, all that would have to be done to determine if someone was Jewish or not is to make the man drop his pants. To reveal it. It would be such a simple thing, wouldn't it, to discover. And it would be hard for Jews not to be circumcised because they still... That's why I'm not so anxious for us to try to stop Jews and Muslims from circumcising their boys. And I don't think that's our business to do that anyway. I think we should make laws in our nations that we still have enough control over against circumcision, outlawing circumcision. And I'll say a little more and be more explicit about that in a minute. First, I just want to mention, as I'm starting out here, there's an interesting article that actually is from August 15th that I noticed, though, in the Los Angeles Times, that sperm counts in Israeli men are plummeting. Said sperm quality is down everywhere, but Israel is worse off than other developed countries. So it says, anyway, theories about why vary from cell phones in pockets to estrogen in milk and water But finding such super sperm isn't as easy as it used to be. Only 1 in 100 donors makes the cut. A decade ago, it was 1 in 10. And it's not, and they're talking about Jewish men in Israel. And it's not just the first-rate sperm that's in short supply. All of Israel's half a dozen or so sperm banks are scrambling to keep their liquid nitrogen freezers stocked. Simply put, the quality of Israeli sperm is falling, excuse me, at an alarming rate, and no one is sure exactly why. Well, in the first place, starting out now with my program now, kind of officially, the first point is no national health organization in the world recommends circumcision. The only reason for circumcision is religious tradition. It seems to me there's no medical health reason or benefit from circumcision, even though they're trying to say that there is. Second, circumcision is extremely painful and traumatic, changes infant behavior, and disrupts the mother-child relationship. This is all from some of the stuff I'm saying is from the Circumcision Resource Center, which you can find on the internet. Very, very good site with lots of pages and lots of good information. So it says the infant, I say, this is my comment on that, disrupting the mother-child relationship. Well, the infant feels betrayed by those in care of it, especially by its mother, and loses trust. And how does this relate to psychopaths, or could it? And there'll be more about what kind of people can be, you know, what kind of problems this can create in adults, because this kind of extreme pain when you're an infant, you think this goes deep into their memory, and it's their mother and the people around them who allowed it to happen. So they have to lose quite a bit of trust, I would think. Not that men don't seem to get over it, but you don't know. You don't know. Some say they didn't ever get over it. All right, why uncircumcised is Jewish language? The term uncircumcised suggests that to be circumcised is the norm, the standard. This is an assumption made by a culture that practices male circumcision. However, non-religious male infant circumcision is not normal in any culture outside of the United States. From a global perspective, to be uncircumcised is to be normal the way males are born, and the way most of the world's males remain. Americans engage, amongst European peoples, Americans engage still in circumcision far more than any others. I didn't know that. I didn't realize that circumcision is practiced very little amongst white Europeans in Europe. It's not popular at all. I guess maybe it never has been, but in America, it's been the norm, although now it's drastically falling, thank goodness. But I'll go on. As the American debate about male circumcision develops, the words intact and natural are being used in place of uncircumcised to reflect this global view. This website uses the three words interchangeably. Intact means not altered, complete, whole. Natural means formed by nature, inborn, in its original state. For various reasons, circumcising cultures generally do not recognize that the circumcised penis is not natural or intact. That's true. Up until a certain point in my life, I guess I would have to say my late 20s, I had never seen an uncircumcised penis, and I never even thought, I have no concept of there being a difference, or, you know, of, I knew what circumcised was, but I just didn't think that it was anything but just something, some little thing that was very normal, that was done for good reason, that not that it made the big change that I found out since that it did. I didn't know that it was that it made such a difference. So All right. In in Jew talk, what they're saying is that circumcised is normal, natural, and they do not consider it not intact. You know, we consider it perfectly natural and normal. In biblical times, circumcision was done to reduce sexual activity by reducing sexual pleasure, maybe masturbation and homosexual sex too, I add, because I believe that this is true. It was done, and I've got some biblical stories coming up later which do point to this very definitely, that the reason for it was to make sex a little bit less enjoyable for men, so they wouldn't want to engage in it so much. The facts are that the foreskin enhances sexual pleasure. The foreskin is what's removed in male circumcision, and it enhances sexual pleasure, and erectile dysfunction and diminished sexual pleasure are the desired surgical outcomes of circumcision, although that is totally denied today, but that's what it was back in the ancient times and since then. And even as late as, say, 150 years ago, they thought that circumcision prevented men from masturbating or too much or things like that. So it all has to do with diminishing the sexual activity of the man and by making it less pleasurable. The medical community has deceived generations of parents about the practice of circumcision. Now, I ask, you know, why has the medical community done this? What interest does it have in doing this? Well, the United States has the highest rate of non-religious circumcisions of male infants in the world. But at the time, now, it's only 32.5%. And the American rate peaked around 1965 at about 85%. So think of how much it's gone down. We can say, well, it's going down and pretty soon it will be gone. Maybe, but we can always, it's something, it's a trend in our favor. So, we can always try to help move it along, even faster. But there's some other issues, good issues for us involved in it. American circumcision rates vary widely depending on the region of the country. I didn't find what the regions were, but a survey of randomly selected primary care physicians showed that circumcision was more often supported by doctors who were older, male, and circumcised. This is consistent with the survey that found that circumcised men are more than four times likely to want their sons circumcised. So this is a male thing, and everybody says that same thing, that if not only doctors, but fathers, if they're circumcised, they, like four times more likely or something like that, want to have their sons circumcised so that they won't look different, so that they'll look like them. They don't want questions asked. And it turns out that circumcision for men is something that many circumcised men are in denial about their feelings. They deny they have any negative feelings about it, it's found that they do, and that it has a lot of psychological effects, but they're not recognized. And the medical profession has a lot of these men who are also circumcised, and they also make those who do these operations make a lot of money doing them. I mean, because there's so many of them, you know. There's if back when it was 85%. Being circumcised, just think of all those babies being born and all those little circumcision things. Now you say, oh, well, the Jews do it to the Jews, but the non-Jews do it in the hospital, and a lot of the Jews maybe didn't do it that well. A lot of them do, but even more and more of them are going to hospitals, but they do have Jewish doctors doing it. Another thing is that the medical community is highly influenced by Jews, and there's a lot of Jews who, in the medical profession, particularly as doctors, the highest level. And this is something that they consciously or unconsciously have a vested interest in. And so this is what we find. And not only the doctors themselves, but the medical associations and the health institutes and so on are also run by Jews are highly overrepresented in these things. So that's another part of the reason. And they say psychologically, like about these the medical profession, people will continue an endeavor once they have invested time and effort. You know, once they get started doing that, they want to just continue. So some circumcising doctors may be protecting their self-esteem in connection with hundreds of thousands of circumcisions they have performed throughout decades of practice. And they say that there's a bias in American public health education. For example, Harvard School of Public Health is in favor of circumcision. There's a bias in American medical literature. For example, the Journal of the American Medical Association. Well, what they say about both of these is that they're like in JAMA, they have of all the articles, medical articles about circumcision, say over the last, you know, however long, 20 of them, 19 are in favor of circumcision. And I don't think the other one was even not in favor. It was just something else. So, you know, they don't allow arguments against circumcision to show up. And this organization has been trying to get it into the media. And I think, okay, I've got that coming up. And they say there's a bias in pediatrics journals. And one is the American Association of Pediatrics journal has come out in saying that overall they would recommend circumcision over non-circumcision. Now, I talked about men, circumcised men being in denial. They write on this website that verbal expressions of feelings require conscious awareness because early traumas are generally unconscious. Associated feelings are expressed non-verbally through behavioral, emotional, and physiological forms. Attitudes about people, life, and the future may also be affected. An example of an attitude resulting from childhood trauma is you can't count on anything or anyone to protect you. The need for babies, I say, to feel protected is huge. You know, we know that. And if something happens in their early, very early life that tells them that they're not being protected from something very traumatic, this can lessen their trust in their parents and authorities and society in general. For the rest of their life. So here's something about bias in the media, American media bias on circumcision. Virtually all mainstream American newspapers and magazines report only one side, the pro-circumcision side of the circumcision controversy. As a typical example, in the last 5 years, the Boston Globe published 20 news articles claiming a benefit for circumcision and no news articles informing readers of the harm of circumcision. And, you know, Boston, I always think, after I've studied Elie Wiesel in the Boston University, where he teaches, and the overwhelming Jewish attitude and Jewish staff and Jewish teachers there, professors and so on, the faculty, is just so incredible. And Boston has always had a large Jewish population. It's always pretty much been under Jewish control. So it's not surprising that the Boston Globe would be behaving like this. The fact that they didn't have any articles in favor or informing readers about the harm of circumcision was brought to the attention of the health editor of the Boston Globe. And he stated that he had other priorities and would not report on the harm of circumcision. So they then called a managing editor about this problem, and they got no response. They had still hadn't gotten any response from him. To offer another point of view, they submitted an op-ed column to 24 major American newspapers. None accepted the column. And they say Scientific American, and that is very Jewish, has published 12 articles about circumcision. Not one discusses the harm of the practice. They proposed to submit an article about circumcision harm. Their proposal was rejected as not meeting their, quote, limited editorial needs, unquote. When we informed the editorial office of their professional and ethical obligation to publish different views on controversies, the idea was dismissed. I guess they would probably say there's no controversy here. Then National Public Radio, NPR, routinely reports only one side of the circumcision controversy. When we recently noted an example and called the NPR ombudsman, she agreed in a September 2010 column that the news report was one-sided, but the NPR still declined to publish an article with another view or broadcast a follow-up story about the harm of circumcision. And the following NPR programs have been contacted about the harm of circumcision and will not accept it as a program topic. All Things Considered, Fresh Air, Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, Here and Now, The Takeaway, On the Media, Radio Lab, Radio Boston, The World, Radio Times, To the Best of Our Knowledge, Diane Rehm Show, Leonard Lopate Show, Brian Lehrer Show, Bob Edwards Weekend, Radio West, Kojo Namandi Show, On Point, Emily Rooney Show. She took over? I don't know that. Commonwealth Journal, The Infinite Mind, Humankind, Tom Hartman Show, Callie Crossley Show, Zorba Pastor, On Your Health. And so none of those people were interested in reporting the other side of the circumcision controversy. Gee whiz. Now, what we do not know, ADHD is 4 times more common in boys than in girls. That's just put out there. It's not, there's nothing tied in to be proven about it, but it's just a fact. And studies about the harm of circumcision are ignored by these people who study ADHD. The effect of circumcision on male distrust, anxiety, and anger toward women is unrecognized and unexamined. Do the psychological and sexual consequences of circumcision affect America's uniquely high divorce rate? We do not know. Circumcision is traumatic and changes the brain. This is what they have found. Because the pain and the trauma that the infant goes through at such a young age, you know, a week or two old, or even earlier, is in a brain that's not at all formed, it has strong effects on the brain. Does circumcision affect the prevalence of autism and ADHD, which both occur about 4 times more often in boys than in girls? We do not know. Sudden infant death syndrome occurs more often in boys than in girls. The rise and fall of male infant mortality correlates with the rise and fall of the circumcision rate. That's what they say. Is circumcision a contributing factor? We do not know. These studies have not been done. Now, for me, the way for white nationalists to deal with this that I have come to after looking into this for a week or so is that is to remember that circumcision, the definition of circumcised or circumcised relates to both males and females. The first definition in the free dictionary online is to remove the prepuce of a male. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And the second is to remove all or part of the clitoris, prepuce, or labia of a female. So circumcision is a word for both male and female. It is genital mutilation. But it's not called genital mutilation for boys. Why? Because it's a Jewish ritual practice, and Jews are in control as I just pointed out above. All these in the media and in the medical associations and so on, the Jews are in control. And so we have the word circumcise for use only for boys. And they don't use the word circumcise for girls in the cultures that, you know, there are cultures that do that. Because they don't want to, they don't want it to be seen, to seem as if they're doing the same thing to boys that they're doing to girls. Because, we outlaw circumcision for girls, as we should. But we don't outlaw it for boys. So it can't be the same thing in our minds. Therefore, they make sure that we don't use that word. But genital, female genital mutilation is just circumcision. It's nothing different than that. And it's the same for boys and girls. They are cutting away part of your sexual organ, and you're cutting away the skin. Okay, in the thesaurus, the first meaning of circumcised says, cut the skin over the clitoris, cut, separate with, or as if with an instrument, cut the rope. So they talk about a female and the clitoris first. The second meaning in the thesaurus, or I don't know what's the meaning, but circumcise, cut the foreskin off male babies or teenage boys. During the bris, B-R-I-S, the baby boy is circumcised. That's an example of a sentence. Remove, take away, withdraw, take. Remove something concrete as if by lifting, pushing, or taking off. Or remove something abstract. Remove a threat. Remove a wrapper. Those are ways to other words that can be used. But so circumcise is really the word for both boys and girls. But in order to hide what they're doing, they want to use the word they won't use the word circumcise about the girls. And this is the big point, is that why do we, if it's the same for both, why do we outlaw circumcision for girls, but we don't outlaw circumcision for boys? One reason only, the Jews. The Jews have it in their religion to circumcise their boys, but not their girls. That's only the Muslims do that. And mostly they do it in Africa. So I don't want to accuse all Muslims of doing that, because they don't. And I don't have any expert information here about how that's all done with girls. But I did look into what they do with girls. And I had looked at it previously. But I tend to kind of forget these things. And looked at it again. It's really awful. But as I really studied what they do to the boys and what it means and what the repercussions are, that's really awful too. It's all awful. So I'm going to now go into some of the what came up in the news that brought all this into public consciousness recently. Excuse me. What started the latest round of debate? Well, on June 27th, a regional court in Cologne, Germany, ruled that circumcision went against the fundamental right of the child to bodily integrity, and that outweighed the fundamental rights of the parents. They added that religious freedom would not be curtailed because the child would be able to choose later whether he wanted to have a circumcision. However, if the parents decided for the boy, it changed the body of the child irreparably and permanently, and went against that child's right to choose his religious beliefs. Well, we can easily understand that the reason they want to do that so early, the Jews, is that the rabbis mark their children for life by this physical change, and they don't want them to be able to choose. They want to do it right away so that you know, they wouldn't even be objecting to it. Because when they show you pictures of boys 4 and 5 and 6 years old who are being going for a circumcision, they're very traumatized. They're very upset. They're crying. They're all nervous. They're all clenching their teeth. And, you know, it's just a terrible. They've been told what's going to be done. And, you know, they don't want it, but they're told that they have to do it. So, but when they're little infants, you know, they can't object, but they do react strongly to the process. So the court goes, this court in Cologne, which, you know, when it first happened, I thought, well, nothing will come of this. But I was wrong, and it is really, what they did is really amazing, and, I mean, it's just fortunate. And it could have a lot of repercussions for the future. So this article from back in June 27th, says the religious freedom of the parents and their right to educate their child would not be unacceptably compromised if they were obliged to wait until the child could himself decide to be circumcised. And I ask, what age would that be? And I conclude that it would have to be age 18, because if it were any earlier than that, that the boy, still being in his parents' home and still very much under his parents' way of thinking and, you know, swayed by their way of thinking and believing in what they tell him and so on, you know, he really would not be acting out of his own volition. And even maybe at 18, they wouldn't be, but at least they would. That's probably as long as you could wait on that. At least by then they would have, they can have the presence of mind to say, you know, I don't want to do this. Of course, that's what the Jews don't want. They don't want that at all. But that is one of the solutions that the German court just suggested. And it's now going to be up to the German government to come up with a solution to this. But we'll get to that. The ruling has now set a precedent that anyone in the future who performs a circumcision on a child not old enough to consent, this was probably just in Germany that this holds, could potentially be breaking the law. The decision is not enforceable in other jurisdictions, but because of the legal limbo and the possibility of charges brought upon them, doctors may decline to do the procedure. This was according to the New York Times. Now, the head of the Central Council of Jews in Germany, Dr. Dieter Graumann, said in a statement that the ruling was an unprecedented and dramatic interference in the right of religious communities to self-determination, calling it an inappropriate and insensitive act. Well, how often do Jews interfere in others' self-determination? My God, you know, they put their interests first in ways that tell other people that they can't do this, they can't do that, they can't do something else because it offends the Jews. And often these things are related to their religion or to their traditional beliefs or to their history as a people, all kinds of things. But this is, you know, as the usual Jewish chutzpah that says, oh, this is just so terrible that you're trying to interfere in our religious rights that we, you know, that to our religious self-determination. So there is another interesting article in Der Spiegel from July 25th, where I'll quote just some from it here and there. The title is "Where Human Rights Collide: Circumcision Debate Has Berlin Searching for Answers," and it says that a fierce debate over circumcision has been raging in Germany for weeks and has caught Chancellor Merkel's government off guard. Berlin is now hoping to introduce a law regulating the practice, but it is a delicate issue due to the religious passions involved. It could take years before it is resolved. Now, that's true. After reading about this all, it could take years because legal things do. And in these years that it takes, if it takes years, we have a great opportunity to push this issue and get it real clear in the minds of white people, even if they're not, even if they're liberal white people or whatever. In fact, the liberals don't like it at all, truthfully. So get this, these practices outlawed in our countries. And I've come to the conclusion whereas before I said that, I didn't care if the Jews continue doing it or if the Muslims continue doing it, as long as we tell white people not, you know, can convince white people not to do it anymore. But I realize now that that was a bit short-sighted, because it's not that what we should do is what I've already said, is that we need to make it illegal in our countries. You know, we, as I said, we have female circumcision is illegal because we call it genital mutilation. We think it's barbaric and horrible. And people are now more and more seeing regular male circumcision as barbaric, whereas you know, it didn't used to be, because it had become what everybody did. It was the norm. It was the norm when I was a little girl, and I didn't hear much about it. But, you know, I mean, I was at some point I became aware of it, and it was just what you did for all white men did that. You know, that's the way I understood it. So, but this has changed so much, and it can change all the way until we can actually, and if we outlaw it, and if we outlawed it in our countries, while we still have the chance to do, we still have enough of people, you know, enough of a majority, or maybe not quite a majority, but we could get up a majority. We can still do this. We need to do it now. Then this would be a way that these other people would be uncomfortable living here, and they should not be allowed either to take their children out of the country and get them circumcised and then come back, which, of course, that's what the Muslims would do. But the Jews, because they have it in their law that it has to be done 8 days after birth, so that's very set, you know, the male child has to be circumcised 8 days after birth. So that would make it a lot more difficult for Jews to be taking their kids somewhere else and getting them circumcised. And if a lot of countries outlawed it, they would have to, like, go to Israel or something, or some of these other Asian or Middle East countries that did it, and they might not feel as comfortable doing that. So it might drive them out. You know, it might drive a lot of people away, and it would point out so clearly the differences in our culture. This is another important aspect of it, that these people have brought things into our cultures which are not us and which are not like us. And they've tried to insist that they have every right to, and they've even gotten us to go along with it ourselves and do it. So, you know, but this can point out the difference between the deep differences between their cultures and our culture, and that they don't mix together. So I'll continue with this, some things in this article, this Der Spiegel article, from July. It says that Chancellor Merkel has welcomed the advice of her justice minister, because she didn't know what to do. She needed to find an answer to this, so she turned to her justice minister, who is a female. And at first, the two women treated the matter as an aberration by a German regional court, which a higher court would later correct. They thought, well, this is fairly simple. You know, this is just unheard of. This can't stand, and this will go to a higher court, and they'll change it, and everything will be back to normal. They thought, how could a few judges from Cologne ban a religious requirement that Jews have observed for thousands of years, and one that all Muslims in Germany observe? But despite the political will, implementing this change is implementing what to do about it is a challenge. Children, children have a fundamental right to physical integrity. And you see, this has never been challenged before. They've just been doing this without having to pay attention to the fact that we have these laws about human rights and all, and children's rights, and children have a right to physical integrity. The German Professional Association of Pediatricians is calling circumcision a form of bodily injury, which really horrifies the Jews. But the child's right then contrasts with those of the parents, which include religious matters. And if the parents want to follow the religious rituals that go back thousands of years for Jews and Muslims, and this is a vital part of their faith, then they claim a right over their child. Now, you know, in most, almost always up till this, I have taken the side of parents over the state and its laws and so on about they're protecting children's rights. But here I come to something where I have to change, where I don't. I'm on the side of those that would protect children's rights against parents who still think that they should do this. And there'll be a little more about that later. Male circumcision, though, as I already said, isn't the only religious practice based on ancient traditions, because female circumcision is also, and I've talked about that to you already, how they distinguish the female from the male by using different words, when it's basically all the same. And they say that other ancient traditions, this is complications to the court case, because other ancient traditions that can be cited as them people having a right to are polygamy, the prohibition of blood transfusions among Jehovah's Witnesses, even the veiling of women. I don't know that that has that much to do with your physical health or what, you know, taking something from your physical body. But these other two, you know, can be brought up and said, well, you know, we have a right to practice this too if it's our religion, just as the Jews can claim that according to their religious beliefs, they can practice circumcision. So opponents of circumcision are now looking to Germany, where legal experts will have to find a solution. So this is interesting. It's more interesting than I even realized that it was until I looked into it more. And we're going to the break, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be having our music by Sleipnir in German, a nice song. And in 5 minutes, I'll be back to continue this with even more interesting things to say about it. See you then.
Dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Erzählt von einer Zeit für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to the Heretics Hour on September 17th, 2012. And this is the second hour of our two-hour show. And we left off talking about the situation in Germany, where this has become a legal problem and it's got to be solved. It's going to be dealt with in the courts through the justice system in Germany, and this is really interesting how this will come about. And they have a problem on their hands because first I was talking about Chancellor Merkel and her justice minister, and they have to decide which code of law should apply to the regulation of circumcision. Should they use the criminal code would be one option, but the problem is that the criminal code is only supposed to regulate criminal acts. They don't want to treat this as a criminal act. So then how about family law? That defines the rights of parents and children. That's another option. And the justice minister has pointed out that the law on the religious education of children, I guess there's some kind of law on that. I don't know what it is, but that's also a possibility. So, they say that a clear legal solution, as the German Association of Judges demanded on Friday, they demanded a clear legal solution to this, is going to be difficult to find because of the nature of it. The justice minister has appointed a task force of senior legal experts to address the complexities of the issue. This is a quote. The matter is more complicated than just inserting a simple little sentence somewhere, as some people envision, says the minister. After this emotional debate, I wouldn't rule out the possibility that the law will come before the Federal Constitutional Court. The judges there will have to determine whether they share the balancing of fundamental rights that we intend to make. This could take years. Now, the balancing of fundamental rights is what the government says the kind of law that they're going to recommend to balance out the rights of the child with the rights of the parents and the rights of their religious beliefs and so on. I don't know how they're going to do that, not being a lawyer, but that's what they say there. Now, this is just a little part from another Der Spiegel story, which is actually a commentary. And it's called Why Circumcision Should Not Be a Crime in Germany. This is my one. Well, I've got one more after this, but about Germany. But Here it is, Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt. And that's his, it's not Goldschmidt or Goldschnitt, but Goldschmidt. The president of the Conference of European Rabbis said, "It's the Germans, once again, who are trying to make it impossible for Jews to remain in their country." In their country, in the Germans' country. I should have Hadding Scott here to read these quotes by this rabbi. But he suggests that we need to have a little respect for people with religious beliefs and be tolerant. He says, quote, "We have eliminated almost all taboos in our society, and we tout this as a sign of great progress. But we need taboos. Child pornography is one of them, and denying the Holocaust is another. Both are punishable offenses." Oh, these Jews. He says, "We've eliminated taboos. We shouldn't have a taboo against circumcision. But we do need to have some taboos, like against the denying the Holocaust, right? And also child pornography, which is all created by Jews. And what about child rape and so on?" He doesn't mention those things. Child molestation and so on. But he says these two things are punishable offenses. But we need to have respect for religious beliefs. Well, I could say a lot about that, but I'm not really prepared to do so, so I'll let that go. Now, one of the latest articles, and this is in Die Welt in Germany, and there's a little bit here that's interesting. It says, "Jews and Muslims gathered in Berlin to demonstrate against a controversial circumcision court ruling. Some said they could not live in Germany if the practice is outlawed." Oh my, how terrible. Oh my gosh. What'll we do? Let's look further at this. "The yes to circumcision must be secured in law," demanded Lala Suskind, who chairs a Berlin-based organization against anti-Semitism. She and around 300 demonstrators gathered at the Babelplatz Square in Berlin to call on the government to pass such a law immediately. The protest was sparked by the Cologne court's ruling in June that this was over the ritual circumcision of a 4-year-old Muslim boy. That was what brought that Cologne court ruling. Something went wrong there. It was just crazy. It was just crazy. His mother was crazy, and the whole thing was nutty. But harmful also. So. Anyway, that's what started that. Now, this article goes on to say this. A Berlin rabbi, Geisa Ederberg, said this ruling was incomprehensible for us, adding that the ensuing national debate was equally troubling. Oh, yes. You know, they hate the debate. The debate is bringing out what circumcision really is. It's just making people more aware of it and studying into it, looking at it, just like I have done. And they hate this because they don't want that. So the debate is probably as bad as the ruling to them. Now, Ederberg says the practice of removing boys' foreskin on the eighth day after their birth is essential for Jews as it represents a bond with God. He said, I say the bond with, now here's some of my commentary. The bond with God is only for Jews. This is the bond of the ancient Israelites. God, I've got some stories about this coming up, so I'll wait for that. But God did not make this bond with non-Jews. He made it with this certain people, so they say. So why are they getting, why are other people getting circumcised? The Jews should actually protest that. It's their thing. But supposedly Americans, who used to do it for religious reasons too, because they thought that they were connected with the Old Testament and so much, although in my something that's coming up, it says that they did it Christians did it because Jesus was circumcised. So they thought they should be circumcised, all these Christians. But now it's mostly for health reasons. It's, you know, it's shifted over, and parents are told that, well, we're all told that that it's healthier to be, it's healthier to be circumcised, which is a bunch of hooey. But they won't publish that it's a bunch of hooey. They'll only publish their one side of it, as we've already seen. Now, a number of Jews and Muslims at the gathering stressed that a law guaranteeing a right to circumcise should not require parents to prove they are requesting the procedure based on religious motives. Well, it should. You know, if they allow it, which I hope they don't allow, but in the end, but to allow it and to say, well, you are allowed to do this because it is your religious, it is a part of your religion. And you say it's your bond with God, and you can't not do it. So you have to do it to follow your religion. Therefore, we give you permission on that basis. But they don't want that. They're protesting that very much. They don't want to have to say we're get special permission based on religious motives. They just want it to be legal. Again, it all has to do with image and maybe some other things too. It's the provision is contained in an interim solution established by Berlin's Justice Ministry, which allows circumcision to be undertaken when it meets certain criteria. So right now, they have to kind of go through this procedure. It's what it sounds like to me, in order to get it, and they don't like that, and they don't want that to be a part of the final solution. Many demonstrators said they would be unable to live in Germany if circumcision is outlawed. Jewish demonstrators. Well, good. You know, if they knew how happy people would be in Germany too, if they left, they just can't say so. But it's just amazing, you know, that they talk like they do. Following the Cologne ruling, though, Chancellor Angela Merkel warned that if Germany were to forbid religious circumcision, it would turn itself into an international laughingstock. Well, that's also backfiring on her by now, I think, because people don't see it as something to be laughed at. They're taking it very seriously. Here's something from the Canadian Pediatric Society, which says it will soon clarify its own position on whether Canadian boys are better off circumcised after its American counterpart came out in favor of the procedure Monday. So this was on August 28th, and we know that the American Pediatric Association came out, their society came out saying that that on balance they recommended circumcision over non-circumcision, but they didn't have a lot of good reasons for it, so they said it was still up to parents to make that final decision, but they thought that it was a little bit better to be circumcised. Now the Canadian Society says it's creating new guidelines based on a review of more than 1,000 scientific articles published in the journal. Well, you know what those articles all say. They're all for it, but they don't universally recommend the procedure for all infants. They're recommending parents make the final call, but they're gonna come up with their final guideline, their final recommendation in about a year. And now here's some of the scientific evidence that supposedly is there that suggests that circumcision can, these languages always got to be paid attention to, can reduce the risk of urinary tract infections in infants. Now, how many infants get urinary tract infections? Well, I don't really know, but I mean, I never heard of it in my life. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. But, you know, with so much unhealthy stuff going on these days, but, you know, I can't imagine worrying about preventing urinary tract infections in infants. How many get such a thing? And it cuts the risk of penile cancer, well, how much penile cancer is there? You know, really, I've never heard of that either. Now, of course, it can happen. I'm sure there are cases of it. But is that something to worry about so much? You know, neither of these things to worry about in order to circumcise an infant to prevent this from happening. And also they bring up sexually transmitted diseases. Being circumcised can cut the risk of getting that. I think what the risk of sexually transmitted diseases is all in how much sex you have and with who. Not so much even how much, but with who and what you know about your sex partner. So that's really the more important thing. They include HIV as, cuts the risk of HIV. That isn't really true. And HPV, the human papillomavirus, and so on. And this whole thing about cervical cancer, doing things to children, they're doing things to girls, they're giving them vaccinations and so on to prevent cervical cancer when the number of cases that there would be is so small, and this vaccination does them more damage, just like the circumcision does far more damage than anything it can prevent. But let's see, they say that the Canadian Pediatric Society is a little more careful than the American one still. They say the overall evidence of the benefits and harms of circumcision is so evenly balanced that it does not support recommending circumcision as a routine procedure for newborns. But that's not their final say. They're coming up with their final say within a year. So we don't know what they're going to say. But anyway, it doesn't matter what they say, because here's something. Dr. Neil Pollack is a circumciser, and he's a Jew from the name Pollack, and I'm sure he is. That's why he has all these customers for his process that he does. He's in Vancouver, Canada. He claims he has performed the procedure more than 30,000 times. He charges $445 for babies 2 months and younger. And previously in this article, it said that the Canadian Health Service gives $150, will pay $150 for medically necessary circumcision for things that, you know, have gone wrong or something with either an infant or an older person that they medically are told they need to have circumcision. So they only pay $150 for it, but this guy charges $445, and his clinic does about 2,500 of these surgeries a year. And he said in an email that we expect a sharp increase after AAP's statement. so I figured out, where is that figure that I wrote down? I figured out, $445 times 30,000. Oh yeah, it's right here. It's $13 million. Well, at that, he's made $13 million. On just his circumcisions over a period of time. But still. Now, going on, this is another reason why the medical profession is, just remains for it, because it's just another surgery that they can make money on. They don't all do this, but they're not, you know, they all allow doctors to make as much money as they want to make. So therefore, anything like this, except for the real principled ones. It says that although the AAP's 1999 statement was fairly neutral, well, I don't know if this must be Canada. It was fairly neutral. The new statement published on Monday in the journal Pediatrics comes down in favor of the procedure, saying the health benefits of newborn male circumcision justify access to this procedure for families who choose it. Well, they're not going to not recommend it. They're not going to not recommend it. But they say that, you know, it's okay. The task force said male circumcision does not appear to adversely affect penile sexual function, sensitivity of the penis, or sexual satisfaction. Well, it's pretty much been shown that it does. It does. But you know, they won't say that. They don't say it. But the group did say it is imperative that those performing circumcision are adequately trained, that they use sterile techniques and offer effective pain management. Well, I've read that this pain management doesn't really work. There's no way to to get rid of the pain, and a lot of this stuff, particularly the topical thing they put on to numb it, to numb the head of the penis, when they do this, they say it has no effect at all because the pain is so excruciating. You know, they can't cover it up. Another thing I have bolded here, we know that cultural, religious, and quite candidly, personal factors very much enter into the decision-making process to the point that if dad is circumcised, Junior may be too, or not, as the case may be. Well, that's true. When parents make that decision, they often do it based on what's the condition of particularly the father, but also other males in the family. And in their area, in their social, you know, where they are, if circumcision is the majority, then they might want to have their son circumcised so that he won't look different from the other kids that he's growing up with. This is a big decision. However, I've read that so many cases where boys were not circumcised, and the most people around them, in one case it was a little boy whose three older brothers and father were all circumcised, and they learned, and they didn't have him circumcised, and when they explained it to him when he was 4 years old why he looked different than they did, he thought he was so glad that he wasn't. He thought it was terrible, and he thought it was just terrible that was done. He didn't want that ever done to him, he said. So, you know, they don't feel different. Most uncircumcised boys say, even if they're in surroundings where there's a lot of circumcised boys, they're glad that they're not, because it's a sense of being intact. You know that you're intact and nothing has been taken from you. All right, there's I don't know if I should go into this. Okay, I'm going to go straight, because it's already 9:22. I'm going to go straight to the circumcision in the Jewish scriptures. I know that there would be some differences of opinion about how this stuff is interpreted and so on. And I'm particularly speaking to my Christian identity friends, because they wouldn't agree with the way that a lot of this is being said. But I think it's important that to say it this way, because it points out the difference between, as we're living now, between Jews and us. And no matter what people believe about the history, the biblical history and so on, that's not something I can be concerned with here. I'm just concerned with trying to just giving you some background in the practice of circumcision, at least according to this article at Symposia that was recommended on the site of nocircumcision.org. So it says the earliest, I won't read that. I'm not going to read all of it. I've got some of it highlighted here. There's a 10th century BCE temple fiction. This is not in the Bible. This is a 10th century Jewish temple fiction about Moses, which suggests that circumcision became Hebrew custom through contact with the Midianites, because there's this story. Maybe I'll read the story. It happened at a stopping place along the way that Yahweh met him, Moses, and tried to kill him. Now, I don't know if Moses is a grown man here. I think so. Moses is a grown man. Then Zipporah, Moses' Midianite wife, took a piece of flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched his genitals with it, saying, "You are my blood bridegroom." So Yahweh let him alone. So this would be, I guess, the son of Zipporah and Moses, and not Moses. So Yahweh didn't kill Moses, after all, because of what she did to their son. At that time, she said blood bridegroom in reference to circumcision. So anyway, supposedly this is in Exodus. I didn't spend a lot of time studying it, so I'm just saying it as it is here. We go on down about, they talk about the blood bridegroom idea and what that might mean and so on. And then, just how the Hebrew word for father-in-law, which means literally the circumciser, may be related to premarital circumcision is not known. So I didn't know that father-in-law means the circumciser. So I guess that's the one who has to see that all the male children are circumcised or something like that. Then it says the reference to the use of a flint blade, you know, she used a flint blade, in an age when copper, bronze, and iron were known and used, suggests the antiquity of the ritual. That is, that this occurred before the copper, bronze, and iron were known, and may indicate a link to the Egyptian custom of using flint tools for circumcision. Now, a 7th century BCE, we're a little bit later from the 10th century, reference to circumcision, which also refers to the use of a flint cutting tool, appears in biblical conquest of Palestine fiction. And at that time, Yahweh said to Joshua, make yourself flint knives. Maybe this is all in the Bible, but they're calling it here fiction because they don't believe it's anything but fiction, this website. But that might be it, because it says this is in Joshua 5:2-3. At that time, Yahweh said to Joshua, make yourself flint knives and squat down and circumcise the people of Israel for a second time. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the people of Israel on the hill of foreskins. Well, that's the way they talk, on the hill of foreskins. It says a reference to the squatting or sitting position is based on the Greek Septuagint or Septuagint rather than the Hebrew Masoretic text. The use of a flint tool and the fact of a mass circumcision once again ties the custom to ancient Egypt. There was a rite at Gilgal. The site of the rite at Gilgal may indicate a hillock where mass circumcision rituals were enacted. Certainly there could be no significance to a massive pile of foreskins. Although it is not specified, it may be assumed that all males were circumcised at this time, both adult and infant. Now, a still later tradition, which is something that I would have probably heard, post-6th century B.C., traced Hebrew circumcision back to Abraham. According to his fiction, the deity made a religious legal covenant with Abraham, the father of the Jewish people, by which Yahweh would be the unique God of the Jews and they would worship him alone. The seal of this covenant was the mark of circumcision. Well, you know, that's the way it seems to me, that it's kind of like that. Although it may have it may go back further in various ways, but the final tradition is like this one with Abraham, and that this was a covenant. And it says in Genesis 17:10-12, for your part, you must keep my covenant, you and your descendants. Every male among you must be circumcised. You must be circumcised. You shall cut off the flesh of your foreskin, and that will be the symbol of the covenant between us. Throughout all your generations, every male shall be circumcised at the age of 8 days. And the regulation included slaves, whether Jewish or foreign. Failure to be circumcised resulted in excommunication from the tribe. The Abrahamic covenant was, according to this site, you see, remember, they don't really go along with any of this as real. They see it as fiction. But the Abrahamic covenant, invented by priests, transformed the circumcision from an ethnic covenant, that is, you know, the Midianites and so on, and whoever they were, into a theological, divinely ordained legal requirement. It's not a puberty rite. It's not a premarital ritual, as was suggested by some of those early stories. But it is a covenantal covenantal sign to be inflicted on infant males on the eighth day after birth to signify their inclusion in the divine promises. So failure to circumcise or be circumcised marks a breach of the covenant. So that's why I say this is not a covenant with non-Jews. This is only a covenant with Jews, or with those who feel that they were the seed of Abraham and part of those Judaic tribes. But they, for some reason, and I know, you know, we can figure that out. They're happy to have non-Jews get circumcised too. And I think it's so that they can't be detected if they want to play the role of a Christian or anything like that, or a non-Jew. They don't want to stand out. So they would be happy to have everybody be circumcised. But that's just an interpretation that I have right at the moment. Continuing with this history stuff, says during the last quarter of the 4th century B.C., Alexander the Great conquered the ancient Near East, and he and his successors introduced Greek customs and culture into the expanded empire. One of the innovations was the gymnasium. The Greeks did not circumcise, and when young Jews, enamored by Greek customs and culture, entered the gymnasium where exercises were performed in the nude, they were embarrassed when their physical deformity became apparent. To conform, they underwent a decircumcision process. And this is written about in 100 BC in the Maccabean Report. They constructed a Gentile-style gymnasium in Jerusalem. They also pulled forward their prepuces, thereby repudiating the Holy Covenant. Well, they pulled forward if you still have enough foreskin left that's kind of pushed back away from the, I don't know, from the tip, you can pull it forward and you can kind of create you don't just pull it forward, but it can be done, you know, by maybe a doctor or something, to look more like you are uncircumcised, and to have some of the benefits of being uncircumcised, because you still have some of that left there to use, and you can pull it forward. And that's what they're talking, that's what they did. And that's what some people can do today. It depends on how much they've cut away. So they say, dependent on how completely the foreskin had been removed, it was possible to cut and pull forward the loose skin of the penis to form a partial foreskin. However, such an act, as the author of Maccabees noted, constituted a denial and rejection of both their circumcision heritage and their Jewish heritage, thereby placing such a person outside the covenanted community. Anti-Judaism became a major issue under one of Alexander's successors named Antiochus IV, who ruled Judea from Syria. He forbade circumcision, and his agents killed those whose infants were circumcised together with the circumcised baby. This is in 1 Maccabees, for whatever that's worth. He was one of Alexander's successors. But eventually, you know, the Jews regained their freedom once again and continued their practices. So interestingly enough, toward the end of the 2nd century B.C., when the Jewish prince Hyrcanus invaded and conquered Idumea, he offered the Idumeans a choice: to be exiled or to become Jews. They chose the latter, were circumcised, and thus became instant Jews. They were not truly accepted by traditional Jews, but Herod the Great, the strongest Jewish ruler, was an Idumean, and he assumed the throne, but his Idumean background earned him the label of half-Jew. So circumcision was not enough. Even though he was circumcised, he still wasn't, according to the Jews, a full Jew, even at that time. So now here it says that other reasons for circumcision that were advocated by Jewish philosophers were to curb sexual desire. Philo, this is what I think, you know. Absolutely. Philo, an Alexandrian Jewish philosopher, born in the last quarter of the first century BC, justified circumcision to reduce sexual desire since engaging in intercourse for pleasure was being like pigs and goats. You know, engaging in intercourse for pleasure was being like pigs and goats. And Moses Maimonides taught that circumcision would bring about a decrease in sexual intercourse and a weakening of the organ in question, and that the bodily pain caused to that member is the real purpose of circumcision. Well, you know, I'll just interject here that from what I've read and what I've learned and even my own experience, it is said, I somehow missed that. I don't know where I didn't put, I thought I had that in here, but I didn't come across it. That women, well, I guess I thought I didn't have time for it, but women also benefit from uncircumcised men's organs because it's better for women too. And there's a lot of reasons, and they all make sense. So to say that if you're uncircumcised, you're going to have too strong of a sexual urge because it's going to be more pleasurable, and therefore you're going to want to have sex all the time, I think it's just the opposite. I think if sex is more satisfying to both the man and the woman, that they don't need to have to be trying to keep having more sex to try to feel the way they want to feel, and they're not frustrated, you know, I don't think they have to be sexual. They'd be less likely to act irresponsibly sexually. And also they would be far less likely to get into pornography and to need all this extreme sex stuff to get themselves excited and worked up in order to have the orgasms, because it's my understanding that circumcised men, and I hope I'm not offending men out there, you know, who are circumcised, because most of the men I've ever known were, but some of them have some complexes that they just didn't perform the way they wanted to, and once they learned about what circumcision does, they understood why, so they felt a little better about it. And the same for women with circumcised men. They don't have the pleasure, supposedly. I think it's true that they would get from an uncircumcised man, you know, just as far as the sex goes. So there's all this religious stuff about, oh, they're going to, you know, we have to curb their sexual desire so that they're more easily controlled or something. Who knows? And I think Jews just like to cause pain. They just like to cause pain, even in their own people. But that's very unscientific of me, what I'm saying. Now there's circumcision in the Christian scriptures. The first Christians were Jews and were circumcised. As the Christian church began to move out into the Mediterranean world and attract non-Jews, circumcision became a problem for converts. The issue came to a head, no pun intended, in the Galatian controversy. Well, you know, I've got my own commentary here, for whatever it's worth. This reminds me of the big tent philosophy. See, the Christians were formed. They had their own thing going, and they could have kind of stayed where they were, or stayed small, or slowly attracted people to them, or worked to get converts amongst the area where they were, or whatever. But the Apostle Paul wanted to spread out across the Mediterranean. And it says in the Bible that Jesus told the disciples to go out all over the world and convert people. But I question whether this person, Jesus, ever said that. That could be them putting, you know, the people who wanted to do that, putting that in there. I think so. Probably much more likely that this was the ambitious ones later who said that Jesus told them to do that. And so they had to go out and convert all the world. This is internationalism. this is a real big tent, you know. And when you do that, you start having all these problems with different people, different cultures, and so on. And that's what they did. That's what did happen, because they had, Paul was talking to the non-Jewish Greeks, and some of these Greeks were drawn to Christianity, but when they wished to join, they were informed by the Jewish element that they had to become, before they could become Christians, they had to become Jews and be circumcised. Or at least they said this was the conservative element. And they didn't want to, you know, they said, no, thanks. We're not going to be circumcised. Sorry. So Paul saw this as a stumbling block in as much as these adult male Greeks were not going to allow that. So, he wrote to the Christian churches and he challenged the validity of circumcision as a criteria for membership in a Christian church. Now there you go, where it's just practical. They don't want to not get members, so they'll change their ruling. That's very, again, like what some of us do, some people do in the white nationalist movement. We'll, what's called watering down, we'll water things down. Now, if they had kept all these rules, maybe Christianity would never have spread and grown like it did. Maybe it would have stayed small. Maybe it would have been just a little sect like many others that eventually died out. Maybe the whole history of the world would have been very, very different. Someone would have to know all this history and then write a story about how it could have turned out differently. But maybe this again was not a good idea. What was done, all this pushing around and spreading around and watering things down, so that we all became mixed up. Now, but in order to deal with this circumcision issue, Paul argued that in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision count for anything. So he left it wide open that you could be circumcised or not be circumcised. It didn't make any difference. But anyway, in Christianity, it was not a religious necessity. It was not a religious ritual that must be undergone. It was not anything to do with bonding with Christ, because there was no longer a bond with Yahweh. It was it was all about Christ. It was the new law, not the old law. So, the new covenant. Yeah, the new covenant, not the old covenant. So, the old covenant was the circumcision, but the new covenant was different. And so, it didn't, you could be circumcised or not circumcised. So it lost its importance, but somehow it got it back again, later amongst Christians, who wanted to follow the letter, to things to the letter. And, ultimately the matter was referred to the Jerusalem Council, where after serious debate, it was decided that circumcision was not a requirement for membership in the Christian community. So, that was the final word on that. Now, for present day Jews, circumcision is both a covenant rite and a naming ceremony. And we know how that's done by the Mohels and everything. I won't go through that. But many non-Orthodox Jews have this done in a hospital setting for their sons. They don't go to the Mohels, but the Orthodox still do, I guess, feel like they must. But they all continue to have their sons circumcised. And Christians, it says here, Christians too have their male offspring circumcised in some cases because Jesus was circumcised, but far more often in an unthinking, uncritical way as something that is done to newborn males. Well, that's really what it came about to, that for most people, for most Christian people who are nominal Christians or whatever, they didn't have any real reason for it, except they just thought that's what you did to newborn males, and the medical profession went along with that. Who knows who was really behind it all, trying to keep people thinking that. But anyway, it says that as better information regarding circumcision is circulated, and the internet certainly helps with that, outmoded beliefs concerning medical or health benefits will be discarded, so that only ancient beliefs will remain as a stimulus for the continuation of this custom. Well, they call it a barbaric custom, but this custom. All right. What I have left is this interview. I'm not going to do this. Okay. Alan Dershowitz. Oh, I've got 15 minutes left. Alan Dershowitz wrote an editorial after this thing, you know, what's going on in Germany with the Cologne court and the circumcision ban. And some of you, I'm sure, have read it, but I'm going to go through it with some highlights that are just really kind of hilarious. They're terrible. They're terrible. It's awful, but it still can be hilarious. But I don't want to treat it as a laughing matter, because it isn't. So he says, shame on Germany for a circumcision ban. He writes, and he's so over the top, so over the top. This appeared in frontpagemag.com. It just says 2012. Why do countries with long histories of anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry seem to care more about the so-called rights of young children not to be circumcised than do other countries in the world with far better histories of concern for human rights? Now, if you're wondering why I'm going to go over this article and some of the others I've done, it's to help us get a grasp of what these arguments are by both the Jews and by the medical societies and so on that are still giving us a lot of phony baloney about it, so that we understand better how to form our own campaign and, if you will, a real program to be serious, to seriously go after getting this banned in our countries, getting it banned on the grounds of the same reason that they banned female genital mutilation. You know, we need, as I've said before, I think it can't be said too many times, we need to show that these two are the same, because they are the same, and we need to use that sameness, that if one is banned, why is the other not? And this should be the final. This should be our final solution. This should be what we're after, in my opinion. So Dershowitz says the same rhetorical question can be asked of countries such as Norway that care so much about the rights of animals not to be slaughtered according to Jewish ritual. Well, he's really got a thing against Norway, because they're not as Jew friendly as he would like them to be. They want to get rid of a lot of these barbaric things that the Jews do, and this just outrages somebody like Alan Dershowitz. He goes on to say, it's not because Germans or Norwegians are better people and care more about children and animals than do Americans. It is because they care less about Jews. Oh my, we should care about Jews. He says, or more precisely, they care a lot about Jews. They just don't like them very much and don't care if they are forced to leave the country because they cannot practice their religions here. No, I hope they don't care. I don't care. And I hope the Germans don't care, whether Jews leave the country. I think that really Germans would like Jews to leave the country. I'm sure they would, but they can't say so. They are not allowed to say that, and they won't say it. But for this Alan Dershowitz, it's so hilarious to say they don't care if we're forced to leave their country, as though it's some kind of a sin on their part. He goes on to say, so let no one praise a nation that now listen to this. Listen to how he talks. So let no one praise a nation that murdered a million Jewish babies and children for shedding crocodile tears over the plight of the poor little baby boy who, following a many thousand year old tradition, is circumcised a week after birth. Every good person should condemn Germany for what really lies at the heart of efforts to ban circumcision. It is old-fashioned anti-Semitism, a term coined by Germans, for Germans, and against Jews. Well, yeah, as far as I know, anti-Semitism was coined by Wilhelm Marr. There could be, that's the way the story goes. He is the first one to use to put those, put that together, anti-Semitism. And because he was an anti-Semite, and he was talking to a lot of German nationalists who felt that the Jews, and this was in southern Germany, I think, felt that the Jews were harmful to the Germans, that they weren't doing them any good, that they were doing bad, and that they would be better off without them, and they would like to get rid of them. But this, of course, is portrayed by Jews like Dershowitz and most Jews as some kind of a sin and hate crime thing, that, you know, that people have no right to want to get rid of Jews. So there's an interesting paragraph here, but I'll pass it by. and Dershowitz says, indeed, there is an ugly whiff of racial superiority in the implicit assumption underlying these bigoted laws, namely that Germans and Norwegians are somehow morally, if not racially, superior to other countries that permit such barbaric practices. Well, here he's complaining that people who don't like their calling their practices barbaric, whether it's ritual animal slaughter or ritual male circumcision, he really resents that they might think that they're morally superior, because that is what the Jews feel belongs to them. They are in the position of being morally superior. And any time they are pushed out of that and somebody else gets in that place, they really don't like it. And someone like Dershowitz will really start screaming like a pig about it. So he says, so let's call a spade and let's call anti-Semitism by its true name. How then should reasonable people respond to these unreasonable efforts to make it difficult to practice in court? No, that make it difficult to practice traditional Judaism. Some have called for a legal response. That means that legal thing about circumcision, that they have to do something about it in a legal way. Perhaps, he says, but fighting these bigoted practices in court plays into the hands of those who are proposing it. In Nazi Germany, respected jurists were able to use the law to justify the most primitive forms of racism. Indeed, Nazism operated through the Nuremberg laws and other such anti-Semitic legal enactments, which were declared entirely lawful by the German courts. So he's going back to that again, as he always does. And he's saying that if we put it in the hands of the courts now in Germany, that doesn't mean that it will be just or fair to the Jewish people, because the German courts will just pass whatever they want, that will be it. And, you know, they don't care. They want the German courts to do that when it's in their favor. They have the courts all over the world stacked in their favor to pass things according to what's good for the Jews and not what's really legally or, you know, justified. But when it comes to them, and when it's not in their favor, when it's not good for them, when it's anything that might be good for the other people. And now I think in Germany they're saying we're interested in what's good for all the people, not just what's good for the Jews. That's a big step forward. Well, he just gets all crazy about that. So he says, some may suggest that the alleged science purporting to support these bans be challenged on the basis of scientific truth. Perhaps, but that too may play into the hands of those who would argue that even acknowledging a possible scientific basis for these bigoted proposals lends some legitimacy to them. Science too was used to support Nazi racial studies. Should German scientists now conduct twin studies on circumcised and uncircumcised siblings? You see how sick this is? he's referring to the supposed cruel and terrible studies on twins that what's the Auschwitz doctor? Now I can't think of his name. You know, doctor, what's his name? It's called Dr. Death and everything. Supposedly he was interested in twins, and he did some studies on twins. So he brings this up. Oh, you know, if we're going to use science, we're going to use science to talk about circumcision. Oh, well, that's just like the Nazis in their studies where they, you know, they did, not barbaric is not the word I want to use, but, what are always called the terrible crimes that they committed against the Jews. So he brings all that up, so that nothing that is said against circumcision will have any validity, because they'll just compare it to things that they say were done against Jews in the past, and therefore you can't do anything against Jews. You know, you really can't do anything against them. He says, now here's his ending. The best response is to shame the Germans into rejecting this new form of left-wing anti-Semitism by showing them how similar it was to the Nazism they now claim to abhor. This approach will not work in Norway, because Norwegians have forgotten their history and still believe they were victims of Nazism rather than collaborators. Norway's anti-Semitic laws preventing kosher slaughter of animals date back to the pre-Nazi period. Now, see, that's anti-Semitic to be against kosher slaughter of animals. It dates back to the pre-Nazi period to have remained in force since that time, Norway seems to have no shame, nor is it capable of being shamed. Many Germans, on the other hand, seem willing to remember the past, at least up to a point. They must confront that past and look at the historical mirror before they once again go down the road of treating their Jewish citizens as second class or worse. He then says, shame on those Germans who would ban circumcision. Shame on those Germans who do not care enough to rise up in anger against the pseudoscientific bigots who falsely claim to be interested in the sensitivities of children. Praise for those Germans who do stand against the bigotry of their countrymen. Then this is the finale. Let other countries with cleaner hands take the lead in conducting real scientific research and in seeking to protect the rights of children and animals. The dirty hands and filthy past of Germany forever disqualifies that country from leading the effort to ban Jewish rituals. For shame. That's his end. And you know, then after all this, he's all upset that if they ban circumcision, that Jews will have to leave Germany. After he talks about Germany like this. You know what? They want to be in a country like Germany, and they want the Germans to be on their hands and knees, kissing their feet, and apologizing for all their past sins. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've run out of time, so thanks very much, and I'll see you next week on the Heretics Hour. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.